So, welcome. We just did the before lecture chant. I'm always humbled to be in the seat when that is being chanted. Somehow I feel like the place of Dharma being spoken is somewhere out there and not in here. You know, my teacher has allowed me to be in this seat, and so I'll do my best. I'll do my best today. And if I mess up, which I'm sure I will, please forgive me. Please pardon my my mistakes. So I'd like to think about today as we embark on kind of a different way of sharing the Buddha Dharma, which is this testing the wide waters of being in person in our sendo, and also simultaneously being with you that are joining us from wherever you are, from Maryland, from Virginia, wherever you find your seat this morning. And it seems like a really simple thing. The tech is working right now, but at the same time, it just requires a kind of a different perspective, maybe there's a different feeling about it or around it. There's something when I was early in practice about walking into a kind of a calm space and sitting and facing the wall and being with other people, but also being very much able to deal with my stuff. And, you know, it always felt comforting to me when I knew my teacher was in the room. I kind of felt that while I was dealing with my stuff, there was somebody kind of watching my back, looking out for me, right? Looking out at me as I was turned away toward the wall. So I wonder how that will be for those of you who are here in the Zendo and knowing that there's a camera on us as we're sitting Zazen and dealing with our stuff. You know, how does that work? How's that gonna serve the Buddha Dharma? But I trust we'll figure our way out. We'll find a way to make the very precious practice of Suzuki Roshi's way available going forward. Because it would be a real shame if it were to fall away into just information or knowledge that's not known by anybody, that's not practiced by anybody. So a lot of us kind of grapple sometimes with doubt, faith, or trust, or is something real? And so this kind of one of those things that I have to kind of believe that what we're doing, what I'm doing, that there's this aspect of trust in it, that it somehow is going to see us forward and preserve what's essential and important. But we might make mistakes along the way too. So that's kind of a little preamble for us having this this first kind of longer day of sitting together in this fashion. I like when I start a talk to think about kind of where we are relative to the season or to the goings on in the realm of humans or the earth. And I thought what might be fun is to share with you a word that was something I learned today, or I'm sorry, yesterday, which is the word lunation. Now, some of you may know what that means, but I hadn't ever heard of the term. And it was in reference to the recent full moon that we've had. I live on the fourth floor of an urban building. And when the moon is as bright as it was this week, it's like somebody has a police strobe light outside my bedroom windows. So I was very aware of this full moon, and it awoke me a couple of nights so that I didn't sleep very much. I didn't sleep after I was woken by the full moon. The moon was almost saying to me, you shouldn't be sleeping. You should be looking at me. And I was like covering up my face with pillows and eye bags and things like that and trying to turn away from it. And maybe I should have turned toward it a little more. Because there was also a partial eclipse of the moon this week. So we had this spectacular full moon and we had this partial eclipse, which in astrology, people that follow astrology, is a lunation, like this combination of events that come together to create certain kind of conditions or a certain moment in time. And it was it's known as the Beaver Moon. You know, so many of the full moon people who observe them are farmers or from Native American cultures, and often the moons are kind of named after animals or trees or that sort of thing. But the suggestion was in some things I was reading that this Beaver Moon kind of calls us to pay attention to our playful side, our curious side, our wonderment aspect in ourselves. And, you know, today as I was out during our break after our morning practice and after I'd had breakfast, I went out for a long walk with my dog, and I kind of found myself, because I was in the silent space of Zazen Kai, really being captivated by the colors of certain leaves in the trees, you know, almost a neon orange and gold, and almost too exquisite to look at for too long. I'm just kind of wondering at that, the quality of creating some spaciousness in our life today to be in a space where there can be maybe not silence, because you know our minds are always yakking, but the space of purposely, intentionally not taking in more and allowing maybe some other things to kind of come forward and out. It's really special right now. And as we go into Rahatsu, week after next, it will be a particularly good time to do that as the days become a little shorter of the sunlight. The winter light can be quite stunning in the winter trees and in the leaves. So please take the time to, and space and quiet to be with the trees and to be with the moon in whatever cast it's in. So I recently had an opportunity to speak to people who work for the Freer Museum, the Freer Smithsonian Museum, here in Washington, D.C. And I shared some of that with our precept study group last Sunday, but I think most of the people that are here on the Zoom and even a couple people here in the Zendo weren't part of that conversation. So I thought I would just bring it up as well today. What ended up happening is the Freer's been given some new art, but they also have a vast collection. And the curator had decided to select 100 pieces of art that he could identify as being created by medieval Japanese Zen monks. So he had all this art that he could identify as being, having been created by this particular vocation of people in Japan. And he knows a lot about art history, but he didn't know a lot about Zen. So somehow they got a hold of me. Truthfully, some of the artwork was really easy for me to kind of decipher and tell them why the subject matter might be portrayed by Zen monks in medieval Japan. But there was a calligraphy that they asked me to look at, and I don't read very much kanji. There are a few things that I know that I can see and read, but this was quite a flowing script and really quite beautiful, just the energy of the brushwork. It was really, really quite stunning. So I had to learn something about this. And so I reached out to some people I know who read kanji, one of whom is in our precept study group. And she was able to translate it based on her knowledge of Chinese languages. And then I also asked someone from the Sotoshu office, and he was able to translate it in both to English and modern Japanese. But the story, it's a little story that is heralded both in the Soto lineage and the Rinzai lineage in Japan. So Dogen Zenji wrote about this story, and the particular calligraphy was done by Zen master Ekkyu. So, you know, sometimes people take a lot of time to kind of draw lines between what's Soto and what's Rinzai. And, you know, whenever that comes up and I'm in a conversation in which Dairyu, Michael Wanger, is there, he often kind of plays it down and he says, don't make a lot out of that. You know, they're really kind of looking at the same things. It's just, you know, some of the practices are different. But I just wanted to make sure, and my understanding, was this like a Dogen thing? Or was this like an everybody thing? And well, it was an everybody thing. So if I'll go ahead and read you one of the translations of this calligraphy. So there are two characters in the story, and they are real people. From Tang Dynasty China. So one of the characters is a very prominent poet, so well known in China at the time that he was heralded as being like Manjushri, or, you know, some just incredibly, you know, fabulous personage in the poetry world. And the people in China still today have great reverence for those early poets, is my understanding. So he was given the post to be, let me back up. He was also a Zen student, right? But he came to it kind of later in life, not as a young kid. So he's an intellectual. He's kind of in the aristocratic society circles. And he's given a posting to be a governor of another province, not where he normally lives. So when he's changed jobs or taken on this other job as being a governor, he decides to study with the local temple master, who is commonly known as Bird's Nest Monk. So why would somebody be called Bird's Nest Monk? Because they hung out in the trees a lot. They had this, the legend is that this young person was, by the time the story is told, the person's 80 years old, Bird's Monk. But he was renowned for having spent a lot of time in nature, up in the trees and with the birds. So here's the governor, here's Bird's Nest Monk. And we could even maybe imagine Bird's Nest Monk being up in the tree, right? And the governor's coming, bowing, having a little dokusan, and the governor says, "Master, tell me, what is the true Buddha Dharma?" bird's nest mud stanton and says, do good, don't do evil. And the governor says back to him, well, come on. Any three-year-old could say that. But the master says, yes, a three-year-old could say it. But this 80-year-old has difficulty doing it. So here we start to have some conversation around really cause and effect, right? Why do good? What is good? What is evil? Those are our first three pure precepts for those of us that have chosen the Bodhisattva way of engaging with our lives, to do good, to refrain from evil for the benefit of all beings. Not just for our benefit, but for the benefit of all beings. You know, so how do we do that? The little Zen master said, I have a hard time. I've been practicing this. I've been trying to focus on this my 80 years. We have in the study of yoga philosophy, this idea that there are these kleshas. There are these kind of, like an onion has all these layers. Those of you that are cooks, you know, if you don't just chop the onion, but like if you peel it, you can peel it and eventually you get to the center. So there's this idea that there are these kleshas, these things that are kind of covering the center. So the center is always there, but something's just kind of around it. So, you know, is it our years that cover this essential knowing how to be good, not do evil? Are there the myriad circumstances, causing and conditions that we encounter? You know, Myoshin San was talking on Tuesday during tea about the methods for being a bodhisattva and the benefits of being a bodhisattva. And part of our conversation was around, well, just sometimes it's just so hard to help people. People don't want to be helped. People don't want to have you, you know, in their stuff. So, you know, how do we do that with a world that doesn't want to be helped? Or an individual, or even ourselves? Right? I mean, a lot of what we were talking about last Tuesday was like the benefits, like if I'm a bodhisattva, if I'm living a certain way, you know, the stars are gonna align a little better for me if I live this way. But if we know that that's the case, why don't we still do it? Why is it still so hard? How will we get it? So we sit some shikantaza, sort of settle things down a bit. Look to create some openness. You know, have some trust in the teachings, in the Dharma that's been passed down. Sometimes it's even to me just kind of like poetry, or like looking at those exquisite neon orange leaves today. Somehow in hearing the Dharma, somehow in sort of seeing the connection, feeling that exquisite perfection for a moment, I can kind of feel like there's a truth there. And I'm wondering maybe if you've experienced that too. I really like this this line from the Dhammapada, the sayings of the Buddha. from the time they arise throughout the day until they go to sleep. The followers of the Buddha delight in doing no harm. Right? Doesn't it feel good to go to bed at the end of the day and feel like, well, I didn't mess up too bad today. That's pretty good. You know, I can delight in that. And if I did mess up a bit, I kind of try to remember the teachings of the 14th Dalai Lama. And he says, yeah, you know, if you messed up the end of the day, kind of take a look at that and reaffirm that you'll try not to mess up in the same way tomorrow. That helps me. So I mess up all the time. So this way is, according to some, exquisitely painful, difficult. But if you're practicing with all beings, you got yourself here somehow. There's some affinity to settling into this way of doing and being, of meeting yourself. And you may still have doubts. Doubts about what you've learned or not learned yet, or teachers or lineages or things that you're not sort of sure are true. And one thing that helps me when I'm wrestling with some of those questions is to remember that the vehicle for the teachings are people. And the people passing on the teachings, they learned from somebody or buddies. And, you know, if a teacher is really skillful, they are conveying what's needed in kind of a tailored way to an individual. And one example of this I think of is, again, in the yoga world that I know pretty intimately, there's a prominent teacher named Krishnamacharya, who lived to be almost 100 and, you know, passed away a couple decades ago. But he was cared for by one of the Maharajas back in those days when Maharajas and princes still had land and influence and money, and he could be teaching the Maharaja's family in the palace and have his own family live with him. So he had a number of sons. One of them is named Desikachar, and he had a nephew named BKS Iyengar. So these two, about the same age, maybe a decade difference in age, these two kind of young boys, right, under his tutelage, they learned yoga. And they both became prominent teachers of Americans. And if you go to anybody who studied with Desikachar, there's this very kind of methodical, repetitive, breath-focused series of things somebody does. And then if you go to a class by somebody who's been trained by BKS Iyengar, you know, everything is like very almost military, you know, alignment of the arm is here and shoulder and stand for a long time in one posture and lots of props, right? You're not just laying on the floor with a blanket, you're using all kinds of belts and buckles and blocks and things like that. So how could it be that these two yoga teachers have such different ways? Right? Was because Krishnamacharya had to teach them differently. You know, the truth of the yoga they teach, the benefit to people is profound. And so when I think of Ikkyu, writing, and evidently he did this calligraphies over and over and over again about the story. He really loved the story. It's really basic, important to him. You know, kind of like, get this. What's the Buddha Dharma? Do good. What is that? Don't do evil. What is that? You know, challenging our fixed views. Pulling us back to that essential. But Dogen too. Dogen asking his students, listen to the story. The story is important. You know, we're in America talking about a conversation by a couple people in China a long time ago. Or I'm talking about it. So there's a phrase that Suzuki Roshi used that I also find some solace or truth in. And that is in his phrase, in their free knowing, they will get it. So the example here is again a conversation, but a modern conversation between Bishop Ippo Shaku, who is visiting Tassajara, the Zen mountain monastery that Suzuki Roshi founded and that many of us hopefully will be going to next June as a community. And so he asked Shunryu Suzuki, what is the future of Buddhism in America? And Suzuki said, I don't know. And recalling also Christina's sharing her I don't know mind, right? Don't know mind through difficulty. We really don't know. The bishop asked if Americans understood him. And Suzuki Roshi said, whatever people understand is okay. By their free knowing, they will get it. Right? So I don't have to unpack it all today. You know, the teachings are there for me to continue to explore and learn. As much as I offer my attention to do so. You know, one of the, I think, important parts of practice, Shikan Tansa is extremely, extremely important. Sitting on your cushion. Please don't stop. But please do study the Dharma. Even if it's a single calligraphy to spend a little time with and to kind of get to know, like I was able to do recently. Or to read a little bit about Suzuki Roshi, or listen to some Dharma talks. But make it your own. Make the knowledge your own. And you can say, oh, it's just a story, it's just a tale. Maybe it happened, maybe it didn't. But kind of become friends with that. I think it's a nice way for us to, by our own knowing, by your own packing of it, kind of getting it. Right? And it's free. It's not just your free knowing, it's actually free. It's there for you. It's like this gift. And I know that there are a few people who are somewhat critical of Zen in America. Buddhism in America, kind of feeling like somehow we've appropriated something that's not ours. And I kind of say just fooey with that. You know, if we, and that's why it's so important when we do our dedications to acknowledge that ancestral lineage all the way back to India, to pay respect for that. To be humble with it, but to also say, hey, we are the legitimate people hearing hearing this and who will pass it forward as best we can. You know, you have a, by your free knowing you will get it, also means you have a place in this time, in this Uji, in this intersection of space and time, connected to all these ancestors, to the trees, to the beaver moon, to each other. We can be humble, but still say we have a right to be right where we are. So I feel gratitude for Suzuki Roshi to trust us, to figure it out. By their free knowing, they will get it. You know, the bishop goes on to say, oh, but sitting is very hard on their bodies. They have great difficulty sitting zazen. And Suzuki Roshi said, that's all I know. That's what my teacher taught me. Right? So we'll use what we know, what we've been able to draw in and convey forward as best we can, you know, with genuine good heart. To do good, to not do evil for the benefit of all beings. So I'd like to offer a little time for people to make comments or questions about this difficult pure precept. Again, it seems like it's so simple, but if it was simple, then well, things be different. So thank you for listening. So here in the Zendo, there are other people, and I'm happy to have any of you share anything or response that you have related to it, or those of you that are the four of you that are in the club with us. Please feel welcome to unmute and speak. Koryu-san.
Koryu-san. Given the first pure precept, the second and the third, why do we need all the other ones?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, why do we need the paramitas? Or why do we need Buddha to continue to provide guidance on how monks might best live together and get along? I mean, I think we humans benefit from having as much support as possible, as much help as possible in figuring it out. And so those other 10 great precepts are just meant to be kind of helpful in unpacking it in a practical way. Yeah, that's my feeling about it. What do you think?
Yeah, I appreciate the point about unpacking and that kind of like Shikantaza, where sometimes it's so unstructured, I think it's overwhelming.
Mm.
Especially for starting at first, or especially for if you've been doing it for a long time and just sitting down this morning, sometimes it's overwhelming. And a framework has has utility.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. Well, I've been really fortunate to be a yoga person for about 30 years before I got deeply into Zazen practice. So the way I unpack Shikantaza is with my body. And just like everybody, you know, my head wants to go a gazillion places, but I'm probably, because of the work with my body and yoga, a little bit more easy to tap into that connection of bone structure and ligaments and muscles and circulation and breathing. And so that for me, Shikantaza is kind of like finding a home, reconnecting to the home of my body, and that integration of mind and body. So, and you know, kind of one thing that helps me too is many of you know the teachings around the Oxfordian pictures. This was, to me, a very helpful sort of pictorial and poetic way of thinking about our Zen practice and working with the mind. And so just kind of very briefly, in each of the 10 pictures, there's a human. The first picture, there's a little boy, and he's just kind of like skipping around and, you know, doesn't have really any cares, maybe stubbed his toe or something, you know, like, what's going on? Phenomena, right? He's a little bit aware of phenomena. And the next picture, he sees some footprints in the mud. Like, what's that? You know, and then kind of through the greenery, he sees this immense ox, just this gigantic thing, new to him, doesn't know what it is. So he like checks it out some. And then he goes and he pokes it a bit. He touches it and he's like, you know, wrestles with it. The ox is like, yeah, I'm very strong. I'm fine with myself. You don't leave me alone. But this kid wants to engage with it. And then they start to get along. They start to kind of like each other, kind of figure it out that you know, being companions is a good thing. And then ultimately the boy is able to actually get up on top of the ox, this huge creature, many, many times larger in strength and size, and just kind of direct it, ride it, right at home. Say, I live over there, let's go. Right. So in this story, the ox is your mind. And your ability to see your mind is that boy observing the ox and interacting with the ox. So the story goes on to where at a certain point, the ox and the boy are just one. There's nothing but the onso. And then the boy has time to kind of reflect on that experience of being completely at peace and unity with the mind as a living human. And he's like, what was all the effort about? Why did I have to struggle so much to do that? You know, now that I've figured it out, you know, why'd I have to go through all that? It was there all the time. It could have been there all the time. And then the final image is the boy, now an old man, kind of rough hands and feet and ragged clothes, patchwork kind of person, patchwork kind of monk maybe, taking what little possessions he has and heading back down into the world to be in the marketplace as a bodhisattva, as somebody with helping hands, right? So when I think about Shikantaza and I think about this story about my relationship with my mind, you know, fully engaging with my living being that I am, is that boy, alive, awake, aware, curious, what's going on? And then sort of seeing those points about my mind, you know, where my mind's going. Look how powerful my mind is, struggling with it. but eventually kind of training my mind. I've often found it helpful for myself, and I've maybe shared this teaching with you guys before, but when my mind is really unruly, sometimes what I have to do is give it a bigger field. I just need to give it more time and space to do what it needs to do, and then I can work with it. I can direct it. My skill will be to, when it's prime, to be able to direct it and keep teaching it that that's okay. So it'll be easier each time. And that does happen for me in Chikan Tanza. It's almost the physicality of getting on the cushion, getting my posture in a certain way, knowing my body, knowing my breath, allows me then to like speak to my mind and have my mind kind of go, yeah, this is what I'm doing. So in this case, my body is kind of the unpacking part that allows me to kind of pull the mind into alignment so that both can just be gone, can be integrated together. But it takes time, it takes work, it takes skill. Myriad causes and conditions impact us to give us setbacks sometimes or make things harder. But you know, we know it's there, it's a through somehow. You know, a thread, even if we're called away to do just completely different things. The practice, once you've done some of it, it's still there. It's this thread. It's like pearls on a beautiful string or something. It's still there. Does that feel okay? I have time for one more comment.
If a child can do it, and an old man struggles, and we seek a child's mind to return to it, how or why do we lose it along the way?
I had a really fabulous art teacher named Marsha Sanmar Wilson. She passed away 3 or 4 years ago now, and she always asked us to paint like a five-year-old. And I said to her one day, I said, you know, I kind of get it, but I kind of don't. Could you tell me what you mean? And she said, well, paint in the fashion you would if you weren't self-conscious. You know, before you started to kind of know how you wanted to look to other people or how you wanted to present yourself, like before that, and the paint that. And I wonder if we are somehow able to tap into that aspect of ourselves more often, if it would be clearer and lighter and feel more youthful. More childlike, our response, more joyful, more playful. I wonder if we let ourselves do that. You know, there I am sitting out on the street, staring up at the trees with these orange leaves. And, you know, people are walking by me, probably thinking this person is a bit of a lunatic. But in that moment, I was just completely doing that. I was not self-critical that I was taking time to do it, and I was just completely not self-aware of how other people were viewing it. I was just taking in the experience, you know? So I think letting ourselves have that quality and saying it's okay is a nice thing. And having people around you to reinforce that it's okay too. You know, people who are willing to giggle with you and joke with you and, you know, look at your bad art and say, hey, that's pretty good. You know, whatever. And do that for other people too. You know, we don't have to be so rough on our friends.
Could I just jump in with a tiny question? Isn't that what teachers mean when they refer to Buddha's mind? Having a Buddha's mind is reverting back to being unselfconscious and childlike, or is that not what that means? What is a Buddha's mind?
Yeah, I'm not positive. I don't personally hear that phrase used very much. I'm not confident what it is that they're trying to suggest or convey. Yeah. I think that there is an aspect of mind awareness that can hold that essential young person's quality, but can also hold the old man's knowledge and quality simultaneously. And I think when I would think about kind of a larger framework for thinking about Buddha Dharma, it would be that holding of it all, that quality of Uji, of bringing, really, you know, experiencing kind of the vastness and interconnection and knowing what to do with it. Yeah, that would be my thought.
Okay.
Dai, did you have this?
Obviously, real quick, thank you for your talk. It was really touching to hear your observation of fall. It's my favorite time of year, and to sit, look at our backyard, and we have some maple trees that turn from yellow to orange. That's the most beautiful thing you've ever seen, right? And so it makes me kind of sad at the same time, because it's so incredible. And, you know, it's the saying that I used to hear a lot in my Zen practice was, here today, gone tomorrow. And it's so literal, right? In the fall time, here today, gone tomorrow. Because it's going to be gone tomorrow, all of this. We'll be in 2 feet of leaves pretty soon. And so my koan with it has been to, how do I celebrate this and not have it have that sense of sadness or austerity that seems to be inherent to it?
To bring that don't know quality. I think that's our discipline. And also to recognize the hubris we have to think that we know how things are going to turn out. Yeah, it's true for my 60 years, most often the trees turn brown or orange and they fall down and people have to do something to walk on them or collect them. That's true. You know, there's been that history. But there could also be some other outcome. So we can we give ourselves a spaciousness to not get locked into the story, but instead to be in the moment, you know, and also to appreciate, you know, the whole aspect of Genjo Koan is that the quality of what exists is constantly changing. And that there's total beauty in that. You know, there is something exquisite about those leaves falling to the ground. So can we find the beauty in every element of it? Maybe that will transport us in such a way that we don't have to drop into the sorrowful aspect. You know, I mean, do we really want to spend time grieving the trees falling? You know, your precious moment escapes the moment where we're living in the future. So yeah, just grab it totally. Okay. Let's go ahead and close with our four great vows. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become him.